Hi, everybody. Welcome to this edition of the podcast Disability Talks, an Illinois Guardianship and Advocacy Commission perspective. This podcast was created to provide information about disability rights and disability advocacy in the state of Illinois through a topic-based interview format. The podcast will be offered quarterly and will cover some of the issues the Illinois Guardianship and Advocacy Commission discovers and confronts and our work with the disability community. The Guardianship and Advocacy Commission is a state agency, in the Illinois state government. The agency is comprised of three divisions that advocate for disability rights in the state. The divisions are first, the Office of State Guardian, which provides guardianships as appointed by a court for adults with disabilities when there is no one else to serve. Second, Legal Advocacy Services, which provides legal representation for individuals receiving mental health services involuntarily. And then finally, the Human Rights Authority, which investigates allegations of rights violations against individuals with disabilities by disability service providers. In addition to the work of each division, the Human Rights Authority and Legal Advocacy Services work together to operate the agency's special education initiative. This initiative enables the agency to provide advocacy tools to families and students navigating special education services in Illinois public schools. We also want to add that while the Illinois Guardianship and Advocacy Commission does offer some legal services, this podcast is all about sharing information. We're not giving legal service here, and it's important to know that you shouldn't use this podcast as a substitute for professional legal help. So this episode covers guardianships and alternatives to guardianships. And joining us for the podcast is Veronique Baker and Barry Lowey. Let's start with Veronique. Would you like to tell us a little bit about yourself?
My name is Veronique Baker. I am the Director for Legal Advocacy Services, and I've been employed in this position since July of 2006.
Thanks, Veronique. And Barry? How about you?
Yes, I'm a licensed attorney since 1987 in the state of Illinois. I have had various roles in private practice and not-for-profits, and now I came to become the program director for the Illinois Office of State Guardian in 2017, and I've been in that position since.
All right, great. Thanks a lot. Thanks to you both for being here. So let's start with just a simple description. What are guardianships?
Do you want me to answer that?
Sure. Anybody could just jump in.
Okay. Well, guardianships are have been around since Roman times and perhaps even before then. It's a mechanism for which a person who's deemed unable to make decisions for themselves is appointed rather than selects a substitute decision maker. In our current jurisprudence and legal system, guardianships are established as a result of a court action. It is essentially created through a lawsuit. The person who is alleged to not have the ability to make their own decisions is supposed to be told about the lawsuit. We call that notice. And they have the opportunity to come in front of the judge and tell their side of the story. That's called a peer. And then in Illinois, you're supposed to have a doctor's report that supports it. And then the court is supposed to determine to what extent a guardianship is necessary. And you have different layers of intrusiveness, if you will, of guardianship, from limited to plenary, limited being just what you can do, but the court tells you can do, plenary being the full authority established under the Probate Act. But it requires a lawsuit, and one of the key social factors about guardianship is it is not there to reinforce familial relationships. It's not there to ensure that the parent maintains rights and control over their child. It is a lawsuit, and it's there to establish a substitute decision maker for someone who lacks the ability to make those decisions for themselves, whether they be financial or personal.
So, when should somebody obtain a guardianship?
Well go ahead, Veronique.
Oh, please. Well, I was going to say that in my experience as representing individuals who were seeking guardianship, usually what happened was they came to us because this person, this family member or close friend, they started lacking the ability to make certain decisions for themselves, either because of an illness or because of an injury or an accident. So we would find that somebody who was normally paying the bills on time, all of a sudden, either they weren't paying bills, or as in one of my own personal experiences, paying the bills multiple times a month because they forgot that they had paid the bills already. They may not be able to take care of their regular basic daily functioning, like eating or cooking or getting lost while they're going to places that they routinely go to. Things like that, things that are out of the ordinary for them. So that's usually what prompted somebody to come to our office when I work at a legal clinic seeking guardianship. Barry, but you do this on a more consistent basis, and since you are, your office is appointed, what do you normally see as the reason why people are coming to get guardians?
Yeah, I'm gonna take a little bit of a step up on the 10,000 foot level and kind of answer this from my private practice perspective when this would come to me, which is similar to your clinical experience, Veronica, I suspect. But I think to summarize when you should get guardianship, Veronica went into the various activities that individuals demonstrate that they're not able to perform for themselves or reason through to be able to get to a decision. I think that from the global perspective, I think a guardianship becomes appropriate when a person needs help and they can't ask for it for themselves because they're unaware, unable to, or they refuse to ask for it. I don't need to worry about the fact that I left my boiling pot of water on the stove for 4 days and now the pot melted and my kitchen burned halfway down to the ground. So in those instances, when a person can't make decisions for themselves, that's when a full guardianship should be looked at. When a person can't make certain discrete decisions for themselves, they're a hot mess with money, then you take a look at that, something a little bit more limited, maybe just a guardianship of the estate so you take control of the money, but you don't tell the person what to do. And so I think from the global perspective, guardianships are designed to help people. That is the theory. They can be abused and used by guardians to financially exploit and other things, but generally it's a tool to establish a helper when the person can't help themselves or won't help themselves.
Thanks to you both. So before we get into some guardianship alternatives, which you mentioned a little bit there, like kind of less restrictive things, can a guardianship be terminated, and like can a guardian be removed?
I did a lot of this work. I mean, there are the Probate Act. The Probate Act is the statute in Illinois that controls guardianships, and so you have to look solely to the Probate Act to make determinations as to things such as when a guardian can be removed or when a guardianship can be established. The Probate Act puts together, like, I think about 10 different things that a guardian can be removed for, and the catch-all one, which is my favorite, is for other good cause. So you can basically drive a Mack truck through that. And basically malfeasance and misfeasance is a basis for removing guardians. But there's also a remedial step before you go for a full removal. And removal can come in a couple different flavors. You can remove the guardianship through what's called a restoration of rights petition. And that's basically you're getting rid of the guardianship in its entirety and saying to the person, okay, we've deemed you now capable of fully managing your affairs, which is the standard of the Probate Act for establishing guardianship and therefore the standard for removing guardianship. And so basically there's the Probate Act sets forth a couple of procedures, one which is largely an uncontested way of doing it, and then the other is a contested way of doing it. But then there's something short of removing, terminating the guardianship. It's removing the guardian, which is what I was getting at with that other good cause thing. And so if a guardian has done something wrong, either intentionally or neglectfully, they can be removed. But the law says that guardianship does not fail for the lack of a guardian. And so a successor or a another guardian would be appointed in that instance. And one step even short of that is a petition to modify the guardian's duties. For instance, the Office of State Guardian has the full authority to make residential placements of its wards, which private guardians do not have. They have to go to court and get approval. Well, one of the things that can be done to the OSG, if a third party determines that we're not making the right choice of where the person should live, a petition could potentially be filed that says that, okay, Office of State Guardian, you have to come back to court and explain to the judge why you want to make this particular placement. That would be an example of modification of the guardianship duties without a full removal of the guardian.
Well, Barry, in the case of a private guardian, does someone have the same ability to make, to file that petition against a private guardian if they make a determination, a selection regarding where a person should be placed? Okay.
Absolutely. Yes. I mean, private guardians, state guardians, and public guardians, which are largely county appointed by the governor, are all subject to the rules and standards of the Probate Act. And so sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander in this instance.
All right. Thanks for the explanation of guardianship. So at this point, I kind of wanted to jump over to different alternatives to guardianships. And I wanted to start with advanced directives. Could one of you two kind of explain advanced directives and how they're used?
I've done a lot of this, but I'm going to defer to Veronique because I know her team is very active with this. So,
well, thanks, Barry. An advanced directive is actually a legal document that allows an individual to state their wishes regarding their medical care if they are unable to make decisions for themselves in the future. It's a way to ensure that your preferences are followed in cases where you can no longer communicate or make those choices, such as if you become incapacitated due to an illness or an injury. So that's the basic definition of an advanced directive. There are a couple of types of advanced directives that we utilize in the state of Illinois. We use a power of attorney for healthcare. There's a power of attorney for property. And then there's a mental health declaration, which are the three that I am most familiar with. And here recently, we've passed the supported decision-making law that allows for people to get assistance and document that somebody can assist them in making decisions.
So you brought up power of attorney for healthcare and power of attorney for finance. Are those are the two different types? Is that what you?
Well, those are two different types of advanced directives, where a person, while they have the capacity, they put down in writing what they want to have happen with their healthcare or what they want to have happen with their finances. They designate a person who will be making those decisions for them when they are not capable of making those decisions for themselves. And those documents, a power of attorney for healthcare, usually does not require it to be witnessed, whereas a mental health declaration does have to be witnessed, and there's a difference in the determination of when a person can actually execute those documents. There, you know, the understanding is that this person has the capability of making these decisions. So at some point there is a decision or an understanding that this person has the ability, the capacity to actually execute the document.
So Gina, I just want to hop in here a little bit and kind of cast the lens of a compare and contrast to guardianship. One of the things about, we call them alternatives to guardianship, these advanced directives. Truly, if you take a look at the power of attorney for property or durable, as it's called in Illinois, that is the counterpart to guardianship of the estate. The counterpart to guardianship of the person, not fully, but at least in the healthcare arena, is the power of attorney for healthcare. One of the things I want to kind of stress is that in the eyes of the law, advanced directives actually are superior to an order of guardianship. And the reason why that kind of elevated status is given to those documents is that the person who's designated the substitute decision maker for themselves is the person themselves, as opposed to a court imposing it. And so when a person is lucid and says, I want this person to help me, we give credence to that.
That's it. Thanks for the comparison. And so since we're talking about power of attorney, what's the process for establishing that? Veronique, you kind of got into it a little bit.
Well, it's basically, first of all, an individual, you don't necessarily need an attorney to complete these documents. These documents can be found in stationaries, they're on websites, there are actual platforms that have a variety of different type of these type of documents based on your state. So a person can download the document, they can read it over, and they can determine, like in a power of attorney for healthcare, who they want to be their decision maker. That's the person is known as the agent. The person who's completing the document is known as the principal. So the principal decides, they appoint an agent, the person who's going to make the decision for themselves. They decide whether this agent has the ability to make end of life decisions for themselves, like whether they want to be just sustained with nourishment and painkiller, whether they want to be hooked up to machines for eternity, or somewhere in between. They can decide whether what medication that they will consent to taking, or they can leave it as broad as possible, with the understanding that the principal and the agent have probably had a conversation about what the principal's preferences are with respect to their health care, and the agent is going to be carrying out the principal's preferences.
Thanks, Veronique. So I guess the next question I have, if one of you two can answer, is describe what a healthcare surrogate is.
Well, that's a generic term, and it's also a statutorily established term. Generically, a healthcare surrogate is just somebody who comes along and helps you either make decisions for yourself or is appointed, say, through a power of attorney for healthcare to be your healthcare surrogate. You got your principal and you got your agent. Agents are basically surrogates. They're substitute decision makers. But I think when we speak in terms of the healthcare surrogate, we think in terms of the Healthcare Surrogate Act. The Healthcare Surrogate Act typically is thought of as an end of life. Are we going to allow the person to remain on life support, or are we going to terminate the life support or not initiate it in the first place? Basically, there was a Supreme Court case in Illinois, and the Supreme Court said to the legislature, hey, listen, we shouldn't be hashing these things out for years and years in court. This should be decisions about your end of life should be made by you and your physician. And so the legislature passed the Healthcare Surrogate Act. It does not require going to court. It does not require establishing a guardian. What it requires is that, and the hospital is required to do this in these circumstances. The hospital is told, when the person can't make decisions for themselves about their end of life, find somebody else to do it. And that somebody else that's identified becomes able to make the decision about end of life when the attending physician, and now the statute's been changed, so you got an attending physician and you have an other health professional, such as a nurse practitioner, advanced practice nurse, MD resident, that kind of thing. And basically the physician with in writing in the record, in concurrence with the other health professional in writing in the patient's record, has to find that the person has a lacks decisional capacity to make the choice about their end of life decisions and has a qualifying condition. I think end of life is pretty self-explanatory. Qualifying condition, there are three of them enumerated in the statute, but basically it means this: you're dying. Nothing we're going to do is going to prevent you from dying. We can only prolong the dying process, and most likely by prolonging the dying process, we're going to prolong your suffering. When those two findings are made by two different professionals in the record, that empowers a surrogate decision maker to make an end of life decision. It doesn't mean that the person, and the statute establishes like a ladder, different rungs, and the highest of which is guardian of the person. So if there's a guardian in place, that becomes by the hospital to be looked to as the prime surrogate decision maker. Then you've got spouse, you've got adult children, the list goes down to close friend. Now, the last on the list is guardian of the estate. I can get into reasons why, but for time, I'm just going to leave it out there that for financial incentive reasons, maybe we don't want those people being the primary decision maker. And so once those decisions are made by the physician and a surrogate is identified, they can then act on behalf of the person who lacks decisional capacity to make that determination. It should be noted significantly that the Healthcare Surrogate Act specifically says that diagnoses of mental illness and intellectual and developmental disability of themselves are not a basis to determine that the person lacks decisional capacity. So the statute presumes that people can make their own decisions and have capacity, and only when the doctors intervene and make those findings is then a surrogate empowered to act.
So what's the difference between a healthcare surrogate and a POA?
So the healthcare, you got to be specific on POAs. We talk about a power of attorney for healthcare because they're the ones that can make decisions about health. The durables deal with property. So what there's the competition between a POA healthcare and healthcare surrogate. Healthcare surrogates are identified by the hospital when the person doesn't have a power of attorney for healthcare. The Healthcare Surrogate Act specifically says, look it, if the person has a power of attorney for healthcare, that controls. Hospital, you look to that person to make the decision rather than sorting through whether or not there is a surrogate to be identified. You don't need those two findings. Basically, what you need is a finding that the person now lacks the ability to make medical decisions for themselves, because by the nature of the power of attorney for healthcare, the person creating the document, i.e., as Veronique said, the principal, that person is saying, when I can no longer make decisions for myself, I trust this person to do it. So they self-identify a surrogate decision maker for themselves.
Great. Thanks a lot, Barry. So we talked a little bit, let's talk a little bit about a couple other alternatives before we end. Veronique, you brought up mental health treatment declaration. Could we talk a little bit about that?
Sure. A mental health declaration is a type of advance directive that specifically deals with a person's mental health treatment. In that document, you're basically stating your preferences regarding how you would like your mental health treatment handled, in case you are in a position or find yourself in the circumstances where you may lack the ability to make that decision for yourself real time. In a mental health declaration, you do not have to appoint an agent. The agent in a mental health declaration is called the attorney in fact. You can appoint one, but you do not have to. You can just basically state, this is my preference regarding my mental health treatment, meaning I will take this type of psychotropic medication, I will not take this type of psychotropic medication, or I will consent to ECT if that is what is suggested, or under no circumstances do I want to have ECT. You can do things like suggest, I'd like to go to this hospital and be treated by this doctor, if that's actually something that can be accommodated. So, and that person is making those preferences known in a document in writing. The difference is that for the execution of a mental health declaration, there has to be two doctors that say that the person has the capacity, or in order for them to actually execute the document. The same is for in terminating or modifying the document. You have to have either a doctor or a court say that you have the ability to, the capacity to modify or terminate your mental health declaration.
So just to clarify, ECT is electroconvulsive therapy. It's a form of administering electricity to intervene with brain patterns to try to alleviate certain psychiatric symptoms, most notably depression.
Correct.
Thanks to you both. I had another question. If somebody could define or describe the Illinois Living Will Act.
The Illinois Living Will Act is a precursor to the the Power of Attorney for Healthcare. It is a mechanism for designating that my preference is not to be kept alive on life support. It's more of a directive to the doctors on what the person's preference is, kind of ancillary to what Veronique was talking about with the Mental Health Advance Directive. You can designate a surrogate decision maker in that document. There's currently legislation out there that's trying to better reconcile the Healthcare Surrogate Act with the Illinois Living Will Act. They seem to have different standards for when they are coming to for the determination to bring them into effect, make them able to be acted upon. And so it's just another type of advanced directive that deals with your end of life decision making.
Okay, great. And thanks to you both. So people that are listening might want to know where they could get some more information about advanced directives and guardianship. Where could they find more info on these topics?
Well, we have an advanced directive booklet on our website, and our website is www.illinois.gov/sites/GAC. We actually have a whole entire booklet that talks about the power of attorney for healthcare and mental health declarations and the differences between them and the requirements for both. It can be downloaded and printed out.
And then on the OSG side for the guardianship, generally the questions are handled by our intake unit. We handle hundreds of information and referral type questions. We have a statewide general information number that is 866-274-8023.
All right. Well, thank you both for your time. I appreciate it, Veronique and Barry. Thanks for the information. Thanks to everyone for listening. If you have any questions about anything that we discuss in this podcast or any other GAC services, please check out the website that Veronique gave you, or call our intake line that Barry gave you. Let me give you that intake line again. It's 1-866-274-8023. Thanks a lot to you both. I appreciate it. And thanks everybody for listening. Have a great day.
All right.
And to all you as well.